My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick, and this is Sonitotum, episode 94. Hello, my friends. On this and every episode of Sonitotum, we talk about making stuff, finding success as we each define it for ourselves, and staying healthy and sane in the process. In this episode, I'm not quite so healthy. I've got a bit of a cold. It's day 2.5. And so I'm going to get in and out as quick as I can, and leave plenty of room for this episode's conversation with author R. Jean Mathieu. Perhaps it's Mathieu. I should have asked him when I had him on the microphone. Sorry about that, Roscoe. R. Jean Mathieu has hauled sail, served tea, hung beef, sold cell phones, and once even used his own coat as a zip line 16 stories above the streets of Hong Kong. He writes every flavor of fiction under a variety of noms de plume. He and his wife Melissa and daughter Lyra keep a good table when not riding side by side or chasing trains to the next adventure. That is all per Roscoe's biography, which you can find along with his award-winning stories at rjeanmathieu.com. I'm going to spell that for you. rjeanmathieu.com. You can also find there at the website his newsletter. And of course, you can find all of his works at amazon.com. But because he does write under a number of pseudonyms, it's best to head to his website first and click the links from there to find out who he is and what those various personas write. All right, folks, let's get right into this conversation with R. Jean Mathieu. So I like to start these interviews, these conversations, by asking a fundamental question that you can go into as much detail as you'd like. What do you create?
I create stories. Some of these stories are for introducing philosophical concepts I think are fun and wish more people knew about. Some of these stories are for working things out. Some of these stories are for providing models for the societies that I am part of to work with. But fundamentally, I like to sit down, glass in hand, and start telling stories to entertain other people.
The follow-up to that, in the spirit of every four-year-old everywhere, but why? Why do you create?
Because it makes me happy. I find telling stories and writing stories and publishing stories a very enjoyable manner, and I am working to make a decent living at it.
Have you thought about or looked at what it is that, well, not just what it is that makes it enjoyable, but why it might be enjoyable for you? What's the underlying drive there? Some things could be enjoyable and it's just purely a visceral kind of thing. Is there anything deeper there? What have you looked at that? Tried to figure out why storytelling scratches that particular itch and why it's itchy in the first place for you specifically?
One is that I come from a family that is very loud and talks over each other quite a bit. Telling stories allows me to be heard. Mm. And two, I very rarely, but I sometimes get to experience someone referencing one of my stories without knowing it because they have internalized it. I still remember when my mother used a metaphor that I used in my, you know, terrible, terrible first teenage attempt at a novel, it's always stuck with me that I have this power. I have the power to put my ideas in other people's heads. So it started out, I could be heard, but it's definitely been reinforced over the course of my adolescence and my adulthood that I can put ideas in people's heads for the better.
That's interesting because I would almost think that point two is really just an extension of point one. It allows you to be heard. It sounds like, you know, you said your family was very loud. I'm assuming that also means it was probably maybe large. And having that, not even volume, but clarity, perhaps, to cut through the noise.
Yes.
To differentiate yourself from the rest. It doesn't get much better than actually transferring a thought, having a thought become a meme in the original sense of the word, you know, a mind virus. That I think those two things are probably connected, one and the same.
Certainly connected. The first is one I remember from early childhood. And no, actually, it was just my father, my mother, myself, and then later on the business that they started, which we all jokingly call my little brother. But we are all extremely bright, you know, red external personalities. We all have very strong personalities, and we all are very loud just by walking into a room. But they are definitely connected. The one is a natural outgrowth of the other as I grew larger and was able to articulate clearer the stories I was trying to tell. Mm-hmm. And has certainly been looming larger since. But that original fundamental, like my mother quoted that when I was 17.
Yeah.
I wanted to be heard by the time I was 4.
Sure.
The one is more primeval and more unfinished than the other. And the other is the more finished and civilized outgrowth of the one.
Right, right. Fundamentally, I think maybe this is why we all, why any artist creates is at a fundamental level, we just want to be heard. I recall realizing that my household, while on the surface, was stable. I never felt like we had poverty. I never felt like things were unstable. There was always food on the table and gifts at Christmas and so on and so forth. But underneath it all was a very unstable marital relationship between my parents. And so there was always an undercurrent of uncertainty, always an undercurrent of what might happen next. And for myself, I realized that I was probably creating from a very early age, especially these widescreen and complicated story worlds. I tend to think in story world rather than individual stories, was a way to establish some kind of order and at least have somewhere where I had a pretty good idea of what was going to happen next. So yeah, hearing you say that, you know, you were one more person in a room full of people who filled up the room, if I may, it rings true, because it all kind of does start with those primary and primal desires to just be heard, just be able to establish a little bit of a plant a flag, perhaps, you know.
Another very large part of it is I get to play. Mm-hmm. This is where I get to go and I get to play with ideas like they were my Legos when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. First reading and then writing gets to open up these delightful places where I can run and play like I was when I was a homeschool kid. Mm-hmm. And I hear you on seeking stability, but for me, it was always, no, this is a place where I can play, where I can try putting things together and see what happens. In addition to the harder edges of wanting to be heard and wanting to put ideas, the softer delight in being able to play with those ideas in the first place is also a deeper part of this that I had not noticed at first.
You made the Lego references, and you really, I mean, being able to create your own Legos, you know, mm-hmm. everything is, mm-hmm. is whole cloth. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. When did this become something, storytelling, whether it was writing or just a gift of gab or what have you, but when did it begin to start to become something that you thought might become a vocation, that might be, you know, a way to make a living, a way that your career, as it were?
So for everything I'm about to say, the fact that I am a Quaker and I go to meeting every Sunday morning is actually going to be fairly key. Quakers, like the pretty much the one theological belief that we would all at least hesitantly sign on to is a belief in the inward light, that we can be spontaneously illuminated by something that is larger than ourselves. And I always was a storyteller. For Christmas break, when I was 13 years old, I had a string of nights where I would listen to the Blade Runner soundtrack and I would eat a grilled cheese sandwich and a pickle and drink a Pepsi. And between 11 o'clock and 2 in the morning, I gave ministry. I gave written ministry, and giving vocal ministry in a Quaker meeting is you stand up and God speaks through you. You get the hell out of the way and you let God do the talking. And I have been blessed to experience that in my writing a handful of times in my life. And that first outburst of, I believe, divine inspiration, certainly something from beyond me, I realized that this was what I wanted to spend my life doing, and that I was willing to sacrifice an awful lot to make it happen. I was willing to bend the arc of my life to make this my vocation and to fulfill this and to chase the possibility of, again, being a channel for words from beyond me. That I was willing to bend my life in that direction just on the chance that it could happen again. And like I said, I have been well blessed that it has happened more often than that. Not often, not even once a year, but it does happen. And it always renews my faith that this was ultimately following a leading, following a path of inspiration. And as my father says, doing the next indicated fucking action.
Yeah. So first of all, that experience you had at 13 over Christmas break, it has so many ritualistic components.
Oh, yes.
11 a.m. to 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. And the Blade Runner soundtrack and I think the Pepsi. You say Pepsi or Coke? Not that it matters.
Pepsi. I'm a Pepsi man. We vote Democrat. We drink Pepsi. That is the way house, of our family.
But I mean, so much of that it is that's such a common experience, whether it's regardless of how it's interpreted by various people, I hear that so often, is that there's a certain ritual that can create or at least make us more receptive to that kind of experience. This might be a chicken and egg question, but in that first experience, was the ritual something that was just, well, I did it last night and this went pretty good, I'll try it again and do it again? Or was it a few nights of, oh, I'm just digging the Blade Runner soundtrack and this is the time that I've got while everybody else is asleep? How did, which came first, the experience, the ritual, or did they develop together?
To all capital F friends who are listening, yes, in some ways I'm not a very good Quaker, because we have an objection to set rituals of pretty much any kind.
Right.
So the fact that it is so ritualistic and the rituals are different now, but remain so, is a bit of a shortfall and a hypocrisy that I chuckle at and long ago accepted. I had been having, so as I mentioned, I was a homeschool kid. That was actually my first year of homeschooling, and my natural rhythms are to fall asleep around 2 in the morning and sleep until like 9 or 10 in the morning. Mm-hmm. So I'd already gotten into a habit of a midnight snack, and it was, I mean, unless they tightened my braces in the past 72 hours, it was a cheese sandwich that I'd nuked in the microwave or you know, a box of Kraft dinner. So that part was already in place. That was the year that I saw Blade Runner, and I you know, talked my mother into buying the soundtrack. I think I got it as an early Christmas present that year, actually, but I knew that it transported me out of myself, putting me in an altered, an altered state of consciousness. And I was raised by hippies. I respect altered states of consciousness as something that is very powerful, and also something that you need to respect and be careful about. So I was like, okay, this music puts me in an altered state of consciousness. and I already had, you know, my midnight snack. I use the garden metaphor a lot. You can't actually make the herbs in your back garden grow.
Right.
You can plant the seeds and you can set the environment to give them the best chance of growing and thriving and coming to harvest, but you can't actually make them grow. And I remember the idea for the first one, and then out of a similar but very distinct direction from outside me, the second night and the third night and the fourth and the fifth, they were not something I had been thinking about. They were not something I had even contemplated before those stories. But I was sitting down and I had prepared the ground for them to come. Mm-hmm. And the next night I happened to have made another cheese sandwich. And I, you know, clicked on my like Sony Walkman, the Blade Runner soundtrack. And I went, I wonder what's going to happen tonight. I didn't know I would write another story that night, but it's like, yeah. Let's find out, man. That year I was very into Renaissance humanism and Da Vinci and Galileo dropping the balls off the Tower of Pisa. So I was like, I don't know what will happen. Let's find out and take notes.
Yeah.
That's how my heroes did it.
And it also, the other thing that occurred to me is so much of what you're describing, and I'm wondering if this has been something that you've intentionally tried to reproduce as well as the semi-annual times that it just does happen. It reminds me very much of a flow state, if you're familiar with that.
Yes, very much so. Yeah. Shmuel Geschke, I believe is how his name is pronounced.
We all make our best attempt at that name, yes. You notice I am not.
Yep. Yeah, I remember reading about him and, you know, my parents missed joining the cast of The Big Chill. Metaphorically speaking,
sure.
They were not reliably informed. It was no longer 1976 until 1998. so, on the bookshelves in my house growing up, we had like Erica Jong's Fear of Flying. We had the whole Earth catalog, and we had a whole bunch of, you know, books on flow state. Where I first came across his name was in Lawrence LeShawn's How to Meditate, which was like the meditation guide for the skeptic in the 1970s.
Yeah.
It's about going into flow state. I am also a karate ka. And when I'm doing my kata, the object is to go into a physical flow state. It is a form of physical meditation. Mm-hmm. And I want to be in that place where I come as close as possible to following the natural flow of the kata. I don't think anyone's ever actually achieved this, mind, but that is the aim, is to reach that flow state. And flow state is the fertilizer for the garden.
Right.
It does not compel those seeds of divine inspiration to grow, but you have to be there for them to sprout.
And I think the other, as I understand it, the other sort of essential for a flow state is to be doing work that both gives you joy, but also challenges you just enough. that would be similar, I think. And I don't have any martial arts experience, but that would be similar, I would think, to moving your body through those, I'm going to use my words, those those exercises, those, you know, the sequences that is going to push you just a little bit. And do you feel like it's the same thing with your writing when you sit down? I've yet to be surprised by someone who doesn't say, who doesn't agree with this, but I think that most writers want to do something a little different, a little harder, a little more challenging each time they sit down to a new piece of work. So that part of it is I think almost built in, but let's hear what you think.
Et bon, de première, vive la différence. So first, just one last note on karate, which in accordance with the goals of this podcast are part of what keep me healthy and sane.
Yeah.
The difference between karate kata, which sorry for using the jargon, but as you pointed out, are the forms. They are the flow. They are the set of movements. Mm-hmm. The difference between kata and writing a story is that in kata, you already know what the platonic ideal of this set of movements is. You can see it before you, however dimly, and you're trying to reach it, knowing that you never will. Like it, you are literally walking through Zeno's paradox.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And with a story, you don't. You're finding out what it is as you do it. And this applies even to editing. I tend to think because I studied anthropology and I you know, even went to field school for a little while. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of excavating something, you know, the first draft gives you the outline of the object, and then the subsequent edits, you were sort of discovering how much more and how much more detail of the object there is.
You're chipping away everything that isn't an elephant. Yeah.
Yeah. So in terms of writing, here comes the controversial part. I have, even before I really understood what writing the other was, I've always tried to follow writing the other by Niecy Shaw. I think that is not only the most practical approach to writing different characters, different forms of fiction, writing people who are not like yourself. And I mean, we've all heard about that study that proved that reading increases empathy. Well, I mean, that's your job as a writer.
Right.
But also the only morally correct approach to writing. You should write more people who are not like you. You should write different people who are not like you. You should stretch yourself. It's the right thing to do. And just today, like yesterday, I finished the first draft of something, and today I put some edits on it of a story that has a very large trans cast. There are three or four speaking characters in the short story who are trans, and it's in a context where transness isn't particularly relevant. They just happen to be trans. And some of them are not the best people. I am not writing model minorities here. Right. And I'm working with a number of trans women who are friends of mine who have agreed to like read for sensitivity. But like, even when I realized this character, that one and that other one are going to be trans or non-binary, I went to them and went, okay, this got here as the story like developed itself. And I went, okay, here's how this breaks down. Do you see any particular problems here? And I am fully aware that employing a sensitivity reader does a tinker's damn for your public opinion, because they can always say, well, no true Scotsman would ever have approved written.
Yeah. Yeah.
Regardless, it makes you a better writer. It makes the story better. And it's the right thing to do. And any one of those is justification enough for doing it, as long as you realize it's not going to do jack shit for your public reputation. Mm-hmm. And I do this because stretching myself makes me a better writer and a better person. I don't know if I'm a better person than anyone else. I don't know if any of these things would make other people better people, but it makes me a better person. So I do it. And I get to discover, and I get to stretch, and I get to try to be a better writer as a result of it. And to get back to Robert Houdin, that is a very enjoyable way to try to make my living.
Indeed. So that makes me think of a couple of things. So the first is, as you mentioned, you know, you can have sensitivity readers. You can take in input from folks who know more than you about a certain thing, whether it's consulting a rocket scientist or consulting, mm-hmm. you know, your trans friends. Mm-hmm. And the reader isn't going to know about any of that or care. If it offends, it offends. There's nothing we can do about that. So you mentioned that, you know, the characters who are trans are not monolithically good angels, necessarily virtuous folks, because they are humans, you know, and in any group, you're going to have everybody who wants what they want, right? At least that's how I see it. And did you or do you give any thought? And I suspect I know the answer, but I'd like to talk it through, you know, mostly for writers at various levels who are listening to this. But did you give any thought to, ooh, you know, if I make a trans person or any kind of minority, the bad guy in giant quotes, I'm going to hear about it. And, you know, it's going to mark me as a writer who has done that thing that some circles say you should not do in, you know, giant capitals. Was that ever part of the equation as you were writing through this story?
I am a white bisexual cis man who is left of center to the point that he calls himself a democratic socialist. I always think about it. I always worry about it. We all always worry about it. At least white cis men do, because we don't want to be terrible people. It always occurs to me. And when I joined SFWA, it shocked me to hear another white cis male writer give voice to the things that had been inside my head since for almost a decade now that I've been thinking about such issues, because I hadn't told anyone and thought I would never tell anyone. And here he was speaking his own fears that were my own innermost fears. And I do draw a very strong distinction in my head between this is writing and this is publishing. And in writing, I have absolute room to play. I can play with ideas. I can play with identities. I can do things like, okay, the novel I'm shopping around is about Doña Doctora Ana Lucia Serrano, who is Indiana Jones with a lot of stuff reversed. She's aristocratic, where Indy is very much a working class hero. Yeah. She's Latina, where Indy is, you know, white Welsh American. Mm-hmm. She is articulately ethnic, where Indy is very American down to earth white collar. She's a woman, where Indy is a man. And like a lot of the inspirations for Indiana Jones, especially James Bond, who is probably the single largest influence on Indiana Jones, she has a lover in every port. Because I wanted to play around with, what if the person with a lover in every port is a woman? Right. You know, what if? And in writing, I have absolute freedom. And as Ray Bradbury said, your right to throw your fist ends at the tip of my nose. Publishing is me going, oh shit. I'm playing into the, you know, Latinas are sluts trope that exists in American fiction. Do I want to go forward with this characterization? And if I do, what do I do about that?
And
I give this as an example. I have taken other paths before. Mm-hmm. With Doña Ana Lucia, she does have a lover in every port, and she is absolutely scrupulous about consent. And part of her aristocratic-ness is this, she always treats her lovers with the kind of respect and the kind of seriousness that Casanova did. She always makes them breakfast. She always, at every step of the seduction process, makes sure that they are absolutely game, absolutely willing, and absolutely free. And if she makes a misstep, she feels that she has to make up for it in order to live up to her own ethical standards, which she takes incredibly importantly and which ties into other aspects of her personality. So she comes off as a kind of female equivalent of a rape, or again, like Casanova. You know, the seduction, the hunt are just aristocratic pastimes to her, and she makes a point of making sure everybody has fun in it. So the way that she has many lovers comes off very differently, at least according to my sensitivity readers. But, you know, see what I said earlier about reputation. At other times when I've noticed the trope calculus, you know, if you have a cast full of gay and you have a story where anyone can die, you're going to end up with some dead gay characters. Like, it's going to happen by nature of the tropes you're playing with. And in one story where I found that I was doing pretty much exactly that, I dialed back the anyone can die and kind of winked at the audience. Yeah, don't worry. This character is queer. They're going to live to see the end. And in another one, I went into it, but I was very clear that everyone is gay, including the people who did survive. It wasn't because they were gay in that particular story. It was based on other considerations. What made the story flow better? Like I said, the way that it happened in this story that I just finished is that I realized that the story flowed a lot better if there were fewer characters, specifically if I merged the accused murderess with the trans character into the same person. Mm-hmm. And what my sensitivity reader, when I ran it by her, said was, this works because her being trans is not the cause of her being a murderer. She just happens to be trans, and you make it clear that she's a complex person.
But just to circle back to the sort of the original question, though, is sure, the characters are the characters, and they all have, you know, motivations that have nothing to do with whatever minority identification mm-hmm. they might have. But, and you mentioned the difference between writing and publishing. So are you concerned? Do you deliberately change things or allow it to affect what serves the story, thinking about, oh, the readers are going to, you know, the readers aren't going to have all this motivational backstory of you, the writer, you know, if you've done your job, they'll have the character motivations, but let's face it, they may not always pick up on those things. Right. So is it a concern of yours that you might change things to avoid, let's call it, the interpretation of a trope when you did everything you could, or you thought you would do everything you can to avoid that? Are you self-censoring, I guess, is the core of the question when it comes to these kinds of things?
When it comes to the writing, no. When it comes to the publishing, including editing, yes.
Okay.
Because publishing by nature has to keep an eye on the market. Writing by nature must be free, or it's not worth the paper it's printed on. I read recently a thread on Twitter that stated, you can't stop Nazis from appropriating what you write. You can do everything right. you can to make them feel unwelcome. Mm-hmm. You can, as a person, loudly announce what you stand for.
Sure.
But you can't actually stop them from reading it the way that you can't stop the reader from reading it the way they choose to read it. And frankly, why would you want to?
Yes. It's a collaboration. Yeah.
Yes. And I don't even tend to look at it as censorship, because it usually requires me to open other roads, and censorship is about closing them off.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, indeed.
I would not have been able to reinforce Doña Ana Lucia's sense of her standards or her aristocratic nature in such a way if I hadn't asked myself, okay, what am I going to do about the fact that I've accidentally stumbled back into the Latinas are sluts trope that right. exists in American media? Mm-hmm. And I saw other roads opening in front of me and went, these look interesting. I'm going to explore these instead.
Yeah, you found a way to make it serve the story.
Yeah.
And I
usually can. It's very, very rare that I have to unambiguously close off some possibility or some combination of elements. There's usually a road that opens when you do that.
Yes.
If all it does is closes roads, I've usually fucked up. I've usually fucked up something pretty fundamental in putting this idea together, this story together, and I need to go back and find out what that is.
Well, and I think that's often a case of simply not digging far enough. And
exactly.
A lot of creators will stop. A lot of writers will stop when they think they've gone as far as they can, you know, but there's always a little further you can go if you not to be light about it, but if you put in the damn work, if you mm-hmm. challenge, we're back to the challenge thing. If you challenge yeah. yourself, if you face some of your own conceptions and misconceptions and whatnot. And one of the reasons I ask this is somewhat selfish. My Shaper's World story mm-hmm. world I treat this, it's an original fantasy setting, and it's not Earth. It's not pastiche of Earth history from any way, shape, or form. It's another world. The viewpoint characters are a variety of human, but they are not humans. And I looked at it as my place to basically say, well, you know what? It doesn't have to be a patriarchy. It doesn't have to be a matriarchy. Maybe there's a middle ground. Social and romantic and familial joinings don't have to be anything that's based on what Western culture is used to as the norm, because they didn't have the same 100,000 years of ecological and biological and sociological history. And it gave me a lot of room to play. And it's also sort of the, well, it's like this because I think it would be great if it was like this, you know, or why not, you know? So bisexuality is not a concept. Homosexuality is not a concept. It's just, there are just pairings, and sometimes beyond pairings, you know, there's communal child rearing. So for my own work, I mean, my last novel, Light of the Outsider, begins with a horrible crime that starts, it's a horrible accidental crime that starts as a female, female, male three-way that is actually completely disingenuous. They're taking advantage of this woman as a means to an end because they are not nice people. And I didn't worry about, oh, you know, I'm setting up this situation where there is, one form or another, there's just this bad seduction and there's a sexual victim. And I thought about whether or not people are going to get three chapters into this and go, this author is fucked up. You know, how dare he, you know, do all these things and you know, have this, I think the term is fridged, right? They fridged this character right at the very beginning, this woman. And not read far enough to recognize, you know, who these characters are and you know, whether or not they get their literary justice served to them and all of that. You know, you have to, there's always a balance, you know, as storytellers, I'll speak for myself, but so often I'm watching like a dramatic TV series and everything is episodic now. You know, there's very few standalone episodes. And usually in the first couple episodes, it's like, okay, well, that character, I already know this is going to happen to them by the end of the season, right? You predict it, but not every reader is sophisticated as a storyteller, recognizing story architecture. So I did consider it and I do think of these things, but I'm also not, I don't change anything because of that. I try to get other writers' perspectives on this because, like your you know, Latina slut trope, I would let the story bear out whether or not that was justified or not. To put it more crudely, I wouldn't give a shit what the reader thought because I want them to experience the character that I developed. And I realized that would probably sabotage traditional publishing options because agents would see that and sensitivity readers might see that and go, oh, you know what? This character could come across in this way to certain people. Do you know who David Simon is?
No, refresh me.
He is the creator of The Wire.
Right. Okay.
He's famously quoted in an article in, I think it was The Believer that, and I'm going to paraphrase, but basically he said, fuck the average reader. And by that, he didn't mean that he didn't respect them or, you know, dislike his readers. He meant that he wants them to be smart enough. He gives them the credit, is how I'm going to think of it, to figure some of this stuff out without having it spelled out to them, without having to be careful with them, without having to give them loads of exposition, which was his next thing, fuck exposition. But but I recognize that it is a balancing act and that there are prices to be paid on the part of the writer, perhaps, to take that attitude, because you are going to alienate some portion of the audience. And so I don't know that there's a right or wrong. I'm certainly not condemning your approach, because I believe it sounds like you've done the work. You've gone those deeper levels that we're talking about, and you found a way to make this a more enriching experience, both for you and with respect to the character. But yeah, it's an interesting topic for me, and this conversation sort of went there, so I thought I'd go a little deeper on it. It's not one of those things where I'm looking for an answer. I'm just mm-hmm. getting another perspective. It's pretty interesting.
So speaking to your particular example, mm-hmm. As a, like I said, a bisexual man who is also polyamorous, mm-hmm. your setup is, I can see this going very wrong, but it would depend on how you played it.
Yeah.
You know, it's the old joke. It's not the joke you tell, it's how you tell it.
Oh, sure.
I can see that going very wrong. There would be a lot of ways for that to easily go very wrong.
And maybe it did, you know?
And maybe it did. I don't know. I haven't read it yet.
Even as the writer, I don't know. Like we said, it's a collaboration, you know? Only the reader can
It doesn't have to go wrong. From the fact that I'm writing this pulp series about this character that mm-hmm. is very steeped in the culture and fiction of the 30s, I love Doc Savage. I did a 6-week retrospective on my favorite Doc Savage novels to celebrate Doc's 90th birthday. And I am straight up, no, some of these are super racist.
Oh, sure.
I don't think Lester Dent actually hated anybody, unlike, say, Burroughs or Lovecraft. He was just a white guy living in New York, and that's plenty bad enough. Mm-hmm. When Doc puts on blackface and speaks jive to pretend to be an African-American cabbie in New York, there is no way that that's going to turn out okay. Like, that's not going to ever work well. Not today. Right. Not anymore.
Right, right.
And, the setup you describe ain't that. Yeah. This could play well. You could do something interesting with it. There might be another road that you take with it that opens up possibilities. I'm not going to rule that out, and I'm probably read past chapter 4. Fridging has been broadly applied to the death of female characters to advance other characters.
Yeah.
But I actually it was the first issue of Green Lantern I bought. I was 10 years old. I have the issue of Green Lantern where the original woman who went into a fridge went into the fridge. The one Gail Simone read and went, fuck this, I'm becoming a comic writer. Like, I own that issue. And in the strictest sense, it's if a female love interest or family member is killed out of hand for no reason, internally or externally to the work, either in the motivations of the characters or to advance the story for any other reason than to motivate her male family member or lover into action. And that's a pretty strict definition. And if it's the female member of the couple that's more affected by this, and if it's not just we need to go on a roaring rampage of revenge, you're now walking away from the worst example of fridging in fiction. Yeah. You're now moving away from that. You're moving on to some other road.
The challenge is that similarly to the way the phrase Mary Sue is often misused, the quote average reader unquote doesn't know that specificity. They don't understand, and that's where it's a wall we could bang our heads against and never mm-hmm. chip. I want to give you an opportunity to answer some of the other sort of tentpole sure. questions about the, I would love to just continue musing on this, but I also want to respect our time. So we've talked a little bit about some of the healthy, sane stuff. And before we go mm-hmm. a little deeper on that, talk to me about your definition of success as a writer and where you think you are on that path, satisfying that definition.
So I have three influences, which I am going to somewhat facetiously thumbtacked 4 years old, 14 years old, 24 years old, and now 34 years old. At 4 years old, my parents are hippies. My parents are still hippies somehow. And the sort of, you know, power of the mind, human potentiality, motivation stuff that was not yet cynical in the 60s and 70s. That was a major strand of ideas in my house growing up. Mm-hmm. So like the definition of success that I have, like, you know, pinned to my bathroom mirror, like I'm Bruce Lee writing his $1 million check to himself in 64
right.
is I am going to sell 1 million books and I'm going to change 1 million lives, because my definition of success is to be heard and to change ideas. And if I can change a million ideas and a million lives, well, by God, that's a success, isn't it? Mm. So that's what was influencing me when I was four. What influenced me when I was 14 was, like I mentioned, I was homeschooled and I was way into Renaissance humanism at that time. The idea of being a Renaissance man, it still looms large in my, you know, life goals.
The multi-potentialite.
The Renaissance man. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I want to be Da Vinci when I grow up.
Yeah. And then 24?
At 24, that was when I read Taoist philosophy. I mean, I discovered Taoist philosophy in my upper teens, but like I was living in China at the time. That's when I read the Tao Te Ching daily. And that idea of success is to embrace Wei Wu Wei and the three jewels. And like to all the Taoists in the audience, I realize I'm massively oversimplifying this, and the way that can be spoken of is not the true way. Wei Wu Wei is the concept of actionless action. It means you're not trying to do something. You are not forcing anything. You are simply following the next indicated action. You are, and if you are not compelled to do something, you aren't doing anything in particular because it is not necessary. And to be successful is to embrace this as far as I am able. The three jewels of Taoism are translated as compassion, frugality, and not daring to be first in the empire, which is a mouthful, so it's usually translated as frugality. To be able to be a natural man, to be what I naturally am, to be the uncarved block, to not expend more energy, more force, more violence than is necessary, mm-hmm. which ties back into being a karateka, the continuum mm-hmm. of force, mm-hmm. And to not attempt to be more nor less than what I am. These, I feel, are marks of success as a sage or as a human being. So that's the influence at 24. The influence at 34 is, my wife was pregnant. I had a daughter on the way. We are currently working very hard to give her a sibling. And, you know, everyone goes, oh, your daughter is your muse. And I go, yes, when I look at her, I realize I need to sell more books.
Right.
That is the influence at 34, is just looking at her and understanding the plain economics. Mm-hmm. I need to sell more books. Mm-hmm. To be successful is to change minds. To be successful is to be a well-rounded man. To be successful is to be a simple and natural man, but also to be successful is to sell enough books so that in the morning I get up, I go to the cafe and I write. Yeah. At lunch, I sell the words I have written. And in the afternoon, I come home and teach my daughter and her siblings mathematics and French mm-hmm. to sell enough books to afford that life.
To have that freedom. Yes.
To have that freedom. Mm-hmm. And I should perhaps also add, as a Quaker, to have the freedom to, when I am called to go somewhere, to be able to go there, to follow a leading if I am called to do so.
Those last few, indeed, come down to, when it comes to the writing career, it comes down to reaching a point where you have the freedom to pursue those other things.
Exactly.
And you know, it's a self-fulfilling sort of thing. If you have the freedom to write, to sell, and to continue to challenge and develop yourself into the ideal that, you know, we chase but never quite reach. Mm-hmm. Well, then all the more chance that you're going to reach those million lives and change those million ideas. And yeah. And I shorthand that as adding to the culture, simply leaving a mark that is, that sustains.
Indelible.
Yeah, that sustains. And so, I mean, obviously, chronologically, of course, you're not all the way there with some of these things, but how do you feel about your, how are your chances?
Well, I can make beer money off of my fiction, and I can afford to join the SFWA. I qualify.
Right.
Which is something that I've been working at since I sent off my first story to Asimov's in 1999 when I was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. I have achieved something that I have been aiming for the past 25 years. I have reached a new level and I am selling more stories, not a lot more, but I am selling more now that I've like reorganized my website, made sure to update the blog on a weekly basis, started a newsletter, yeah. Inserted, you know, gone back and inserted back matter into all of my books, done, you know, a whole bunch of publishing work.
All that infrastructure stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. All the publishing work, which is fun in itself. Fun mm-hmm. enough that I have to monitor that I'm still doing actual writing at times.
Procrastination. Yeah.
Procrastination. My daughter understands the French language. I am successful, at least in one of the things that I have wanted since I was a teenager.
Yeah.
I have changed minds. I know because they have told me. Mm-hmm. I had one guy who nearly caused a traffic accident, swerving his car, driving down the street to wave one of my on-stolen mimeograph zines that I made when I was 14 or 15, swinging it out the window, going, "This is amazing, man. This is incredible." And I was astonished because
that's the perfect word for it. Astonished. The first time that happens, the first few times it happens is humbling and inspiring.
And we all aspire to be Neil Gaiman where it always will be because we inherently recognize, no, that is the correct way to handle it. God give me the grace to be Neil Gaiman every time I'm confronted with a fan.
Well, it's always in a way that I never expected every time it happens. So it's almost easy because I never would have guessed that X would have affected Y in that particular way, you know, but damn if I didn't make that thing.
Mm-hmm. And I do continuously challenge myself both to make my writing better and to develop new skills. I have taken up running. I still hate running, but I always feel better after I have run.
And, just like writing.
And no, I love the process of writing. No,
that's just that's the old saw.
I know. I've never truckled with it, I'm afraid. But it is challenging for me, but it also develops new spiritual, mental, and physical skills. Mm-hmm. There is a purity to running psychologically. All you have is you and the run, and you have to convince yourself to keep going. Mm-hmm. That's hard.
Oh, yeah.
And it is a useful skill to have because it applies to so many other things. And the thing about being a Renaissance man is finding all of these connections between seemingly disparate objects.
Yes.
I remember in college writing in the margins of my accounting class, Newtonian physics and double entry accounting are the same thing. Mm-hmm. They are both action and reaction and the records of same.
Mm-hmm.
And
always having a balance.
Ultimately. All things will balance in the end. Yeah. Speaking of Taoist philosophy, being a good Quaker or trying to be a good Quaker has been the single greatest contribution to me living out my Taoist principles. I've got an article that's coming out in Western Friend later this year, A Friend with Taoist Notions, which is about how my Taoist philosophy plays out in Quaker practice and how the two interact with each other, pardon the expression, in a yin and yang sort of way. They cycle into each other. Mm-hmm. They arise out of each other. Mm-hmm. And one arises and falls back into the other in a sort of waveform. That one is absolutely a work in progress, and always will be. And thank God for that. It's like my karate. To some degree, I can see the Platonic ideal I'm aiming for, and I'll never quite reach it.
Yeah.
And that is, in fact, the point. You keep trying.
Yes. That sounds a lot like, so much of your, speaking of the overlapping Venn diagrams, much of your thoughts about success and reflections on where you are in those terms are also the ways that pretty much since you were 13 or 14, also the way that you're staying healthy and sane as a creator. Does that seem fair?
Yeah. No, I have what I call the hat trick. And the hat trick is if I do my stint, Jack London always called it his stint, his 1,000 words a day.
Yeah.
If I do my stint, if I do the foundation kata of my style, San Qin, and the three of them, which is required, and I sit, as Quakers say, in retirement, which is a Quaker meeting of one, of being open to the still small voice or the leading of God or the inward light, that is a good day. Today, I have fulfilled my goals for being a well-rounded human being, and those things are the things that keep me sane. That is the strict symbol that I am remaining healthy, sane, and well-rounded.
That's so important. I want to emphasize that for a moment. And if I misstate it, let me know. But what strikes me about that I think so many of us miss is that, and I'm going to kind of wander around this as I form the thought. So often, especially, I'm going to say especially, but I know it's not exclusive to writers, especially newer writers, they tend to be in a comparative race. They're always, you know, looking at other folks and saying, oh, this person writes X number of words a day. I'm never going to be able to do that. This person has this many books and blah, blah, blah. And they're racing against these external things. And what you've described is your signpost, your flag. And what I think is important to emphasize is that if we each figure out what that is for ourselves, then we won't necessarily feel as if we haven't done enough. We haven't pushed, because we're not competing, not with ourselves, not with anyone else. It's more to achieve to reach that goal without feeling dissatisfied, you know, figuring out where it is, you know, here we come back again to doing something joyful and challenging yourself just a bit, right? And not feeling as if you have not done enough, but recognizing that you did what you set out to do every day. Is that a fair sort of sum up?
I have some thoughts and I have some anecdotes. Number one, I am at a temperamental advantage here. Like I mentioned, my father was the only man in PTA when I was in kindergarten. And he was a recess monitor in kindergarten one day, and he noticed that all the kids rushed onto the trikes, and they went around the track as fast as possible, shouting and whooping and racing each other, trying to be fastest. And he noted that his boy right over there was ambling around the track, calling out hi to people, looking at stuff, and just completely ignoring the race.
But taking it all in.
Yep. And he said that he had a very firm grasp of this aspect of my character in that moment. He understood what kind of boy his boy was. Mm-hmm. So when I was 10 years old, 12 years old, he didn't push me into team sports. He figured that team sports was never really going to be a thing that worked for me. I wasn't wired that way. Mm-hmm. He pushed me toward sports where your challenge is yourself.
Yes.
Because he understood that that was something that I would understand a lot deeper and a lot faster. It was not alien to the way that I, to the way that I thought.
Right.
It really is a thing of like the old poem goes, each morning sees some task begun. Each evening sees its close. Working, loving, harrowing onward through life, he goes. Each evening sees some task begun. Each evening sees its close. My father also made me memorize a poem a week while I was homeschooled. The village blacksmith was definitely chief among them. That an if. And I have a short in my head. I've described it. I have an electrical short in my head. When I do something, I don't feel accomplished. And many years ago, I wrote about this in my blog. I wrote, I would have the parties. I would, you know, have the wine and I would feel hollow. And finally, I came to a point where when I did something that I intellectually recognized as worthwhile, I started a ritual. I would take down the little old box of green tea from Hong Kong that my parents somehow or other acquired. I would open it. I would make myself a cup of tea. I would listen to Pink Floyd. And I told myself, this is the acknowledgement. I have done something that was worth doing. And usually I would weep.
Closing the loop.
Yeah. Because I never feel that. I have an electrical short. I don't feel that. I've gotten better about it, but still, when a story of mine is accepted, or I finish a novel, or I have a child, and there are three goals in my professional life at my day job that I have in mind for this, and I've already picked out the cigars for it, I light a cigar and have a tumbler of whiskey, and I usually go visit a family friend and my brother-in-law, and we play chess together because this is my way of acknowledging I have done a mighty work here. No, Roscoe, sit down. Right. Stop for a moment and understand this. You have accomplished something.
Take the victory lap. Yeah.
Because otherwise I will never feel it and I will rob myself. And I don't believe in being overcharged for life.
So, if you've heard episodes of the show, interview episodes, you know that there's this sort of corny close up that I do at the end. If you could sort of distill everything that you've learned about making stuff and finding success as you define it and staying healthy and sane, everything that you've learned in your creative life and bring it down to maybe a bumper sticker or a needlepoint you hang on the wall, what would that ridiculously and impossibly pithy phrase or statement be?
Know your hat trick. Do your hat trick.
Nice.
Have those three things every day that are diverse enough to make you a well-rounded human being. And do them every day. And when you do them every day, note it, because this was a success. Each morning saw a task begun, and each evening saw it close.
I think that's great. I think you've succeeded in creating the bumper sticker, you know, because I think it's especially that last bit, the acknowledging that you did the thing, is so important. Your ritual with your brother-in-law and the chess game, the cigar and the drink.
Absolutely, the cigar.
The cigar and the drink, you know, it's a closure. It's erasing the circle after you've summoned the magic, you know? And I think that, I mean, you know, sure, people will say, oh, you know, I'm going to reward myself when I'm done with this thing. But I think it's pretty important to recognize that you are doing a ritual, that you are deliberately, well, as I said, you know, erasing the circle, cleansing the ground, you know, for the next thing, wiping off the blackboard.
And on that note, I do have to say, for me, it has to be small. It has to be humble. I can go to the parties afterward.
Yeah.
I can't go to the parties before. I have to have that moment to myself to recognize for myself that I have done a mighty thing today.
Yeah.
After that, I can celebrate.
Yeah, I think that's an important clarification. Absolutely.
When I was younger, I kept confusing the celebration for the acknowledgement. Yeah. And that didn't work very well.
Oftentimes the celebration is a distraction from the self-recognition. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Well, is there anything in brief that has occurred to you as we've been talking that maybe we glossed over or skipped, or you wanted to re-explore or add to?
Especially for younger writers. Mm. Since I was 14 years old, very smart women, very feminist women, have always acknowledged that I write women really well. As a teenage boy, I wrote women preternaturally well, which honestly, I can only ascribe to divine inspiration. I was a fucking idiot. that's a cornerstone of my philosophy of like divine inspiration in the writing process. Under my own power, I could not have written women as well as I did, period. There had to be something from outside me that was causing that. And I leaned into it. I write, like, at this point, the majority of the characters that I write are female, trans or cis, because it was something that everyone remarked I do well. So I went, might as well write this. Mm-hmm. And it does make me a better writer because I am writing someone who's different from me. Similarly, a great many of my characters are Chinese. I lived in China for 5 years. I feel very comfortable writing Chinese characters, but they are different enough from myself. And I have a talent for it. My Chinese readers all comment, yeah, you are an egg. You have a white outside and a yellow inside. Their phrase, I swear to Christ.
I've heard that. Yeah, I've heard that phrase.
So I lean into that. I write more Chinese characters, which works really well. I'm usually writing about Chinese philosophy. Mm-hmm. And about a decade ago, I realized that one of the stock features in my stories is there's usually a cool big sister character. She's not always a blood relation sister, but she's always sardonic. She's always a few years older than the main character, whatever gender they are. And she will often give them trickster type advice, partly because she wants to fuck with them and partly because she thinks that they'll be better for having figured it out, but partly because it's fun. I don't try to put her in there, but there comes a point where it's like, hey there, how you been? Mm-hmm. Good to see you again.
We all have our personal tropes. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And a friend of mine commented that the Matuvian ending is when the main character experiences a moment of indescribable pure mysticism where they understand exactly what the next steps have to be. And they follow them because doing otherwise would take actual work and they don't want to put the work in to avoid it. And there is a short denouement as they and we, the reader, discover how they are changed by this encounter with something beyond themselves that they cannot put into words. He noted that this is the Matuvian ending because this is how a good 60-70% of my stories end, regardless of genre. And I looked back on it and went, he's right. And I've leaned into it. Like, over the course of time, young writers, you will these thumbprints of yours. Lean into it. They are your strength. Bob Heinlein put himself into every single book he wrote, but it was never the same man twice, right. Which is why they're interesting to read.
Yes.
And I don't think anyone had as clear or as many creator thumbprints as that man. but like, seriously, the things that keep cropping up in your work, and you're not going to know them in the first dozen stories. You're not probably not going to know them in the first two dozen stories. And you're probably going to need loving friends who whack you upside the head with, this character has shown up in every single story you've ever written, or I'm officially naming this kind of climax to a story after you. But lean into them. When someone tells you this is a thing you do and you do it a lot and you do it pretty good, like lean into that. You will discover more stuff there. There are more roads leading out of there than there are roads that get closed off by following it. Mm-hmm. If you want to challenge yourself to write something other than what you have discovered your personal tropes are, your thumbprints are, that's good. Challenge yourself. But also lean into what your thumbprints are. You will find more freedom there than you will find trying to fight it. It takes work to actually fight these kinds of things. Just go with the flow. Wei Wu Wei.
As you were talking about your trademark ending.
Mm-hmm. The Mithuvian ending.
The Mithuvian ending, yes. And you may not agree with this, but immediately in the back of my head, like a thunderbolt, so much that I was like, okay, listen to what he is saying and come back to this. It sounds like in your fiction, your characters are revisiting your 13-year-old Christmas break.
I am unsurprised.
Had you made that connection before?
No, but I look at it and go, that's the thing. That's how my father speaks. So, like,
isn't it fascinating, though? I mean, it's all in us.
Unsurprising.
Yeah. Really.
It also, like, the connection I did make is it does reflect my understanding of and experience with the Tao and my Quaker practice, which is strongly rooted in direct apprehension of the divine. Quakers were started when George Fox stood on Pendle Hill and realized Christ is come to teach the people himself. And that guidance is always there. The divine is always there. You can always consult it if you shut up long enough.
Yes.
And there is, of course, that old joke that the only time Quakers shut the fuck up is for an hour on Sunday. But like, I had made the connection. Yeah, my characters sort of by default have this sense of mystical union, because all of my stories are about exploring philosophy, especially the pulp novels with all the punching, especially the romance novels with all the kissing. They're all about me exploring philosophy. And for me, the ultimate philosophy is trying to describe the indescribable, knowing that I will never succeed.
Right. Right.
And it does all go back to that indescribable experience that I had when I was 13, when I first was blessed to be a channel for the written ministry.
Yes, a literal formative experience.
Indeed.
Well, this has been really great. I'm going to repeat myself because almost every conversation that I've had this year with other writers for this show has provided something different, provided a different perspective, provided different insights, and above all, been full of value for the listeners. So thank you so much for taking the time and for sharing with us.
Thank you for having me. It's always nice to be heard.
Well, there you have it, my friends, my conversation with Roscoe Mathieu, who once again you can find at rjeanmathieu.com. That's rjeanmathieu.com. You can also find links to all of his stuff over there at mattselznick.com/sonitotum-094 for the show notes for this episode. If you have anything you'd like to say about this episode or any episode, of course, I welcome your feedback. You, as always, can reach out to me directly via email at matt@mattselznick.com. That's mattselznick.com. matt@mattselznick.com. Or you can leave a comment in the show notes for this episode, sonitotum094 at mattselznick.com/sonitotum-094. So it's been a stretch of time between this episode and the last episode. I was out of the country for a couple of weeks, and I've had some familial obligations and, as always, various professional obligations. And it'll be probably at least 2 weeks, maybe three, before the next episode, episode 95. That episode will feature the writer Anna Zygelhoff. So I hope you will stay subscribed for that and everything else that's to come. Doesn't cost you anything, of course. Being a subscriber is free. So just don't touch that RSS feed, wherever it is that you get your podcasts. I would like to take a moment before I sign off to thank the folks who do pay to support this podcast and my other creative endeavors. My beloved multiversalist patrons, who include Chuck Anderson, Amy Bowen, J.C. Hutchins, Ted Leonhardt, Jim Lewinson, and Pearl Zare. I so appreciate my beloved multiversalist patrons. You can become a patron for just $5 a month. And hey, there's a 7-day free trial. Join the member community at mattselznick.com/b-a-patron. And you can see all the goodies that you get along with your patronage when you go to mattselznick.com/b-a-patron. Join the small but mighty group of patrons who have been there for quite a while now and who I love so much. All right, gang, I can feel that this is just sliding into the mud, and I need to blow my nose really badly, which is probably not something you needed to hear. I hope you enjoyed this interview conversation as in-depth as always, and that you'll stick around for the next one. My name is Matthew Wayne Selznick. Take care.